Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 334 of the podcast. It's Saturday, 12th of August, 2017, as I record this. So today I'm talking with Jerry B. Jenkins about the Christian market, his tips for a long career in writing, and how it felt to have a hit with the Left Behind series, which has sold over 60 million copies. And what I find particularly interesting about this chat is that Left Behind was Jerry's 125th book, which I love because we all hear about the lightning strike debuts that make lots of money and the outliers and the rare authors like Lee Child who have one series that sells incredibly well. But the truth about the writing career, I think, is that someone like Jerry is much more, you know, someone we can emulate in terms of our work ethic and what we enjoy with our writing, the process of writing, you know, writers who keep producing. And maybe sometime one of those books will be a lightning strike and you don't know which one. So I really find this a really interesting chat and I hope you will enjoy it too. Okay, in publishing this week, not too much going on. It is August, which is often a downtime in the publishing industry. But first of all, there was something in the Ingram Spark newsletter. If you use Ingram Spark, you'll get that newsletter. And it says, through a new strategic relationship, you are now able to sell your titles in China. China's book market reaches 10 million English speakers and 300 million English language students. Let me repeat that, 300 million English language students in China. That is almost as big as the American population and what, three times bigger than, no, more than that. But much bigger, five times bigger than the UK market. Their main market segments are most interested in professional, academic and higher education, children and young adult titles. Take advantage of this opportunity by enrolling in the Global Connect program in your Ingram Spark account. If you have already added Global Connect pricing to your title, there's no need to take any action. Your titles will automatically be available in China. So I find this very interesting. I mean, first of all, if you are an Ingram Spark, just go and check your global pricing and you'll be there. But of course, we all know that availability does not mean sales. So I'm definitely interested in how we can all sell more books to English speakers in other countries, as you all know. But this really caught my eye as another example of expansion into China, which is starting to definitely happen. Kind of along the lines of the themes of this show, I also want to recommend checking out the Science Fiction and Fantasy Marketing podcast this week. Great podcast, and not just for science fiction and fantasy authors. And this show in particular is relevant whatever you write. Lindsay, Jeff and Joe talk about breaking six figures as an author and maintaining six figures and what it takes to make it. And they go through two different surveys and also talk about their own experience in a completely non-hypey way, which I really like. And it is really important to realize that being a six-figure author or a multi-six-figure author or a seven-figure author, and you'll get this with Jerry's talk as well, is it's actually more work than a full-time job. And I was talking to Jonathan, my husband, about this week. It was our ninth wedding anniversary and we kind of always reflect on the year and what we can do better in the coming year and if there's anything we need to change, you know, between us or, you know, do we want to carry on for another year? It's a good way of kind of checking in. And you know, one of the things that I've said is I'm working so hard. I'm working really hard. And how we can change some of the balance of some of the work I do, you know, because yeah, it's great making good money, but it's a lot harder work than I ever did before. And I love it. And that's the thing. It's a real balance behind doing the work you love and also kind of considering what you don't love and removing that. So it's a continuous focus on you know, trying to figure out what bits you want to keep and what bits you need to get rid of. So interesting. So go and check that out at marketingsff.com. And it's episode 144 on breaking six figures as an author. I'll also link to it in the show notes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts and episode 334. Okay, so my personal update this week, I finished the draft of the map book, which I have several possible titles for, but I'm still trying to decide whether it is a series or a standalone. The story finishes, so it's a, you know, you could read it as a standalone, but there are elements that could definitely make it into a bigger series. I'm trying to decide what I want to do. I'm really pleased it's finished. I only started writing the first draft in June, so it's not been that long in terms of a draft, plus I was away for a couple of weeks in New York and all of that. But I did start researching it in December last year. So I know because I keep a fiction writing diary of sorts at jfpen.com/now, N-O-W, and, you know, which is what I'm working on right now. And it's a kind of rolling update of what I'm doing. And I posted pictures of research books on maps that I was reading back in December. I did the outline in New Zealand in February, and then I was in New Orleans, and then I did The American Demon Hunters and How to Market a Book, and all of that took longer than I expected. So basically, I started the draft beginning of June. So the actual writing bit of getting words on a page hasn't been too long, but the thinking and everything has been 9 months. So it actually feels like quite a long time. And I'm really happy to have that first draft done. It's resting for a few days. I will do a bigger edit over the next couple of weeks and then give it to my editor and then get back into the line edit. So there's quite a bit of editing to do, but I'm really happy to have that first draft done. My mum also delivered me book 3 in our Sweet Romance series, which is a real milestone because as we, you know, Lindsay's show talked about and I've talked about before, 3 books, you can actually start considering some proper marketing and you can do a box set and you can, you know, you start to understand how to write a book. And my Jonathan calls me the machine because, you know, I work hard and now my mum is known as mother of the machine because she's really got into writing. And as I said to her this week, she's very, very lucky because she doesn't have to publish or market. She just produces and she loves it. And I've asked her if she wants to come on the show or do a blog post or, you know, if we can come out and put our pictures out there, and she's just not interested. She just wants to write and have fun. So I'm like, okay, fair enough. So I'm going to edit that. Well, I'm still co-writing that. I mean, technically, you know, my level of writing development is higher than anyone who does 3 books. I'm on book 25 now. So I'll basically go through that, do the line edits, and then we'll get that to a proofreader. So that will be out in October, which is pretty cool. So I have 2 very different books to edit in the next couple of weeks. Fun times indeed. I have a new audiobook out this week as well, the Arcane Box Set 1, which contains Stone of Fire, Crypt of Bone, Ark of Blood, out now on Audible, and it's nearly 20 hours of action-adventure thriller goodness with an edge of the supernatural and a backdrop of European history and international travel. And I'm really pleased to get that out because, as I've said before, fiction audio is really important that it's longer than the credit. Unless you're a famous author, if you have short audiobooks, they're just not selling that well. So they have to be longer than the credit. And the credit is normally around 8 hours, is worth about 8 hours. So if your audiobook is under 8 hours, then it's kind of less than a credit. So this is over 19 hours. And I'm really hoping that this will sell well, and that it will, I've seen this with my other fiction box set, it sells much better as a box set than the books do individually. So if you have a credit available on Audible, go check out the Arcane, Arkane,
it's an acronym, you can look up JF Penn and you'll find all my books there. Super deal. And if you do listen to audio fiction and you're interested in getting a review copy, I do have some audio codes, then email me joanna@thecreativepen.com and I will give you one of those. And hopefully you'll all enjoy it. I really need some reviews on there so I can start promoting that. So fun times. Thanks also to everyone who did the survey on The Healthy Writer. After these two fiction books are off to the editors, I will be getting into The Healthy Writer as we move into September. And it seems that it's everyone's who's answered it. And we've had, 1,200 responses to that survey. People are saying it's a really necessary book. So fun times on that too. Okay, useful stuff. I'm super excited this week to be doing a webinar with Joseph Michael, the Scrivener Coach. Now, over the years, I've done webinars with Joe. I haven't actually done one for over a year. And I'm excited because I always learn something new about Scrivener from Joe. And of course, since we did the last webinar, I think Scrivener is now on the iPad. So that's cool. And so we'll be talking about the syncing with Dropbox and all of those types of things. And I've now written 24 books in Scrivener, including this last MacBook. And the first thing I do when my mum sends me her manuscript is put it into Scrivener and start organizing it. So I love Scrivener. It is my number one writing tool. I used to use it for formatting, but now I use Vellum. Scrivener is amazing. I use it for organizing fiction and nonfiction. And I'll also be doing a bit of a slide up front on how I use the Inspector for the Inspector, which is this little extra bit on the side of the main writing pane where you can track things like polarity and value shift, which are really important in story, cliffhangers, conflict, and more. And Joe will be giving a value pack presentation on how you can use Scrivener to write more efficiently. So join us this Thursday, 17th of August, 2017 at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. And if you register, you can get the replay. So thecreativepen.com/Scrivener17, or again, the links are in the show notes. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Josiah said after last week's Wattpad show, I tried Wattpad out before, never made much headway, so it fell by the wayside. But while listening, I decided to take another look and found an interesting tidbit. One of the big time fantasy writers, Brandon Sanderson, has one of his traditionally published books on Wattpad, a brilliant marketing move on the part of traditional publishing. So obviously traditional publishing is paying attention to these sites and using them. So that's interesting. Ged said, another great show on Wattpad. I listened to it yesterday while out walking and looking at the Southern Alps. I set myself a limit, and if I haven't gone out for a walk by Thursday, I take your podcast and away we go. Fantastic. The Healthy Writer podcast. I might have to do a special edition on that. Pamela said, I've been binge listening to your podcast this summer and bringing it with me on my commute and different trips. I mostly listen on the way between Uppsala, where I live, and Stockholm, where I work, which is very cool. Karen Wyatt, listening to the backlist while cycling up Copper Canyon in Colorado and psyching up to edit my latest nonfiction book. Gorgeous canyon picture there, Karen. Bobby Kittens on Twitter said, inspiring to listen to the back episodes when you only had two books and you were worried about having to get a real job again. Oh, Bobby, that's awesome. That was probably back in 2011 or 2012. It's so interesting. What I love about the podcast and the blog is that it's a sort of, you know, time lapse of a writer journey. And sometimes when I read back some of what I wrote years ago, I can't even believe I'm the same person. So I hope that does encourage you if you're feeling like you're never going to get there. Or if you listen to Jerry and you're like, oh my goodness, how am I ever going to get to that many books? Well, it's just a case of, you know, writing a sentence and then writing a paragraph and then you know, these things turn into pages and pages and books, and that's exciting. FR Medina says, after listening to your Thriller Fest podcast, I feel better about everything. I'm not alone in these feelings. No, you're definitely not. Jamie Kern said, survive this paint scraping session by listening to the show, and sent me a really cool paint scraping gif, which I couldn't stop watching, which is quite scary. And finally, lots of different ones, but finally, Wilhelmina Ulemar says, this Saturday, I'm listening to the show while making my way to brunch with a creative friend. Recharging the creative well really is so important. Thank you for reminding us. And that's very cool. I think we all need to remember that too. Recharging the creative well really is important. And I'm going on holiday in a couple of weeks, and I'll obviously announce that on the show. We're going walking in the Dolomites in Italy, and I'm really looking forward to that. I'm sort of I love traveling to really exciting places and busy cities. You know, New Orleans is a classic example, or New York. These are very busy cities, very tiring in many ways, and I get a lot of brain input there. But I do find my walking holidays are so important for kind of turning off the brain after walking for sort of, you know, once you've walked for over 5 hours, I think you really start. Just feeling that a lot of perspective is the right word. That's what I was looking for. I'm a writer. I should know words. Perspective is the right word. You start appreciating things like food and water and rest and shelter and a shower. And when you do a multi-day walk, so we're doing sort of 5 days in a row, you start to understand physical pain a lot more, and that it's strangely satisfying in many ways. So I'm really, right now I'm actually starting to look at next year, 2018, and trying to figure out where the various walks are. A number of you have said that you want to come and do the Isle of Wight Ultra, so we will probably have a team for that. I'm going to start organising that soon. Lots of things going on physically, so I hope you guys are all looking to recharge your creative wells as well as we come into September. And then I just feel like we're heading towards the end of the year, which is kind of scary. We've still got a quarter left to go though, haven't we? Or a third, September. Yeah, okay, a third. So time to get together and achieve things before the end of the year. Right, let's get on with things. Today's show is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course, which I created while writing End of Days, so you get a behind-the-scenes look at how the book came together. I'm also updating it over time with new Q&A videos, and the course has videos, audios, and slides, so you can do it at your own pace. We also have a private Facebook group where you can ask me any questions. So is it for you? Well, is it your dream to write a novel, but you just don't know where to start? Or have you started writing only to run out of ideas? Or are you suffering from self-doubt about whether you're good enough to write a novel? Or do you feel overwhelmed by all the information and craft books out there and just need to cut through the noise to what's really important? So if you've answered yes to any of these questions, this course might be for you. One course member, Tess Manchester, said, "The best part about your course is that you introduce a concept, explain it, and then follow it up with real examples to solidify it. If ever I'm struggling, I can go back to a real scene and recall what you said about whether it would be related to setting, character, or whatever, and that puts me back on track." Another student, Rana, said, "I'm learning a lot, more than I ever did doing other courses." So find out more at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. So this type of sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Laura Purdy Salas, MJ Rios, Sean Callahan, and David Goldston. And thank you to everyone who has supported the show for so long now. It's so exciting. I love our Patreon little community. It means such a lot to me, and it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And I will be recording the extra monthly Q&A directly after I finish this intro, which means you will have listened to it already if you're a Patreon supporter. That will have gone out for August. So you can support me on Patreon with just a couple of dollars or a couple of coffees a month. and you will get the extra Q&A as well as all the backlist Q&A. And I do answer a lot of really interesting questions, both beginner questions, but also pretty in-depth questions about marketing, about being a creative entrepreneur, about money and all kinds of things. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/ The Creative Pen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Today, I'm here with Jerry B. Jenkins. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Joanna. Great to be with you.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. Just a little introduction. Jerry is the New York Times bestselling author of more than 190 books with sales of more than 70 million copies, including the awesome Left Behind series. Now, you've probably written more than that now, Jerry, and sold far more, right?
A few more, but I'm so busy teaching writing online now that I'm writing a little less.
Yeah, well, we're going to come back to that later because that's awesome. But I wanted to start with the Left Behind series because I was reading those books, a number of years ago, and they've been instrumental in my own fiction. So I wanted to ask you, how did those books come about and why do you think they struck such a chord with readers all over the world?
Well, this was really the idea of Dr. Tim LaHaye, who was he had been a pastor and he was a nonfiction author. And he had spoken and written a lot about the end times over his career, and he'd had some pretty good selling books. But he noticed that everywhere he went, people were reading novels. And he thought, I wonder if I should, try to put this in fiction form. And he tried. Apparently, he did it himself or he got somebody else to help him, and it just didn't work. And he realized he wasn't a fiction writer. And so my agent called me one day and he said, asked me if I'd ever met Dr. LaHaye, and I had not, but I was aware of him. He's a pretty famous evangelical here in the States. So I said, I'd love to. And he said, well, he said, he's a best-selling nonfiction author who has a great fiction idea. And you're a novelist with no ideas. So, so we need to get you two together. And we hit it off immediately. He passed last year, but right about this time. In fact, it was a year ago today that he died. The reason I know that is my oldest son's birthday is today. And I remember how ironic that was. But Dr. LaHaye was the age of my parents. So he died last year at 90. Mm-hmm. And so there was almost an immediate father-son type dynamic there. And I loved the idea. But that's where the idea came from. And I had been raised in the same tradition. So I believed the same way about the rapture of the church and people disappearing and that type of thing. So it was really fun for me to get to write this.
Mm. And I'm fascinated with this because when I read the books at the beginning, I was in a similar evangelical church. And, back then my beliefs were different and have changed over time. But I wonder about walking the line between writing about what many people believe as truth, but of course you can't know what's truth because the rapture hasn't happened yet. So how do you walk the line between faith and truth and also fantasy and kind of future apocalypse?
Yeah, that was the tricky line to walk because obviously we were writing about something that we believe will happen someday based on Dr. LaHaye's interpretation of scripture. I'm not a theologian or a scholar, but I agree with it I'm really coming at it as a layman, but I agree with his view. And so we decided that I would write the novels as literally as possible. He says, let's take it literally unless the scripture says otherwise. If it says it's like unto, then that's a comparison. But if it just says fire and blood and hail came from the sky, then that's what you write. And so we just went ahead and told the story. And basically what I was doing was putting fictitious characters in the way of these prophetic events. So I, in essence, had the grand outline. There was going to be seven judgments, three series of seven judgments that come over a seven-year tribulation period. But we don't know exactly how quickly they follow one another, whether there's months in between or days. And then what would it look like if this happened just the way it says? So that's just the tack we took. And we didn't, for one thing, we didn't think it would be so successful that people would care to comment on it. We thought it might be exciting because I asked Dr. LaHaye early on, I said, am I writing to our tribe, the people who already agree with us, and they're just going to be encouraged by this? Or am I trying to persuade people who have never heard of this or wouldn't believe it. And he said both. And I said, you know, I thought since I was talking to a theologian, I'd wax spiritual. And I said, a double-minded book is unstable in all its ways. And but I couldn't get him off that for a year. In fact, I had to put off the writing of this for a year because I got the invitation of a lifetime to assist Billy Graham with his memoirs. And I think had the publisher or Tim LaHaye known what would become of Left Behind, they probably wouldn't have let me do that. But they were happy for me too, and said, you know, that is a privilege. So, but during that year, I kept trying to tell Dr. LaHaye, I need to know the audience I'm writing for. And he kept saying both. And so all I could do when I finally got to it was simply do justice to his view and his position and just tell the story. And keep in mind that I'm writing to a lot of people who've never heard of this idea at all, and they might just be interested in the story. And I think that might have been the secret. The other part of your question was what made it catch on. As far as from the fiction standpoint, it's just a great story. I mean, if you just think about whether you know it's based on scriptural prophecy or somebody's view of it or not, it's an epic good versus evil story, and has the, you know, the futuristic feel and the disappearing of people and where they go and what's this all about. And in the first chapter, since this happens, all the people who would understand what it was are gone. So the language has to be not inside lingo. It's searching scared to death people wondering what is this and searching it out. What we found was that people were fascinated by the end of the millennium coming. It's hard to believe the first book in this 16-book series came out in 1995, almost 22 years ago. It'll be in August. But people were already thinking about the end of the millennium, and we didn't see the connection, but everybody else seemed to. They said the end of the millennium, people start thinking about the end of the world. I'm not sure why, but that really seemed to help. And then, you know, 9/11 came in 2001, and that it just brought some of the horror of some of the things I was writing about come close to home. I mean, we had always, you know, here in the States, we've been separated from this kind of violence by either oceans or decades. And all of a sudden, here it is on our own shore today, you know. And so all that working together turned this thing into a phenomenon that we had no idea was coming.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. And I remember I was reading Frank Peretti at the same time, you know, sure. The sort of Running with the Demon and things that, you know, were not in people's experience, but things that potentially had a basis in scripture. And I think that, you know, that they are good as you could just read them as kind of right now, sort of apocalyptic fantasy novels or almost thriller novels. And I wonder, are you seeing a sort of resurgence in interest? Because that was obviously 1995, you know, I can understand the whole millennium thing. But now we're also kind of facing an interesting political time and, wars and rumors of wars and all of that type of thing. Are you seeing that people still want these books?
They really do. And the series continues to sell. I mean, it did well over 60 million in its heyday. But, you know, the whole series is probably selling somewhere between 100 and 150,000 units a year ever since. And that's, you know, that's not like it used to be, but that's amazing for anything to even stay in print that long. And the interesting thing here is that no matter who gets elected president over here, the other half of the country believes they're the Antichrist. And so they write and say, doesn't this prove that, you know, Obama's the Antichrist or Trump's the Antichrist or Clinton or whoever's in office? It literally happened every time we had an election. We would get deluged with letters saying, this must be the Antichrist. And they go, yeah, you must be the other side of the political spectrum. And of course, our feeling is that nobody's going to suspect the Antichrist. The scripture is clear that the first 3.5 years of his reign, people not only don't suspect him of being the Antichrist, they think he's God incarnate. He's so attractive and bringing peace and all that stuff until his true colors come out. So we're always happy to say, if anybody thinks he is, then he probably isn't.
Then he probably isn't. And that's actually quite good for book sales, because it doesn't matter who becomes president, it'll keep selling. Well, that's fantastic. But it's really interesting that when I was reading your biography, because many people obviously became, or I heard of you because of the Left Behind series, but I read on your bio that it was your 125th book. So, you know, that's crazy. And so my kind of question here is, you know, many authors think that the first book they write, that it's going to become a bestseller and they'll be able to quit their job and be a millionaire. But you kind of walked this journey for 124 books before, I think, this was your biggest hit, right? So how do you kind of stay the course over the long-term writing career?
Well, I consider my, and this is going to sound falsely modest, but I really consider myself mono-gifted. I've got one gift, and that's writing. And so I feel obligated to exercise it. So I was, for a long time, working full-time. I was a vice president of a publishing company, and we published books. And I was writing on the side and churning out all these books. And some of them were fairly successful. I mean, we were going to be able to pay off our house and put our kids through college and that type of thing. And so I was enjoying the career. And I thought having a better writing career than most, because most writers starve, as you know. But I'd had a few hits that weren't, you know, they weren't New York Times bestsellers, but they'd sold, you know, six figures. And so I felt, you know, I was enjoying my career, and this came along when I was in my mid-40s. So, you know, when it hit, I had had one New York Times bestseller before that, but it was nonfiction. It was a sports book. And so I'd had a little experience with success, but nothing like this. This just started to become an avalanche. You know, good book sales. People talk about, they'd love to have a book that sells 100,000 copies, and they don't realize how unusual that is. That's just, you know, that's a career book. Well, when Left Behind took off, you know, none of the previous books in the series went out of print. They just kept going. And the first book in the series at the heyday of the sales was averaging 275,000 sales per month. and the rest of them were similar. And so it was like, first, we made a joke of it. What are we supposed to do now? And then it was, we really didn't know what to do. It was just overwhelming, the success of these. And so I'm kind of glad it happened to me at that age and not, say, mid-20s, because I don't know. And I'd like to think I could have handled it. But what it tended to do, when the first big results came in and it was like a million sales for the first three books total, that's pretty spectacular. And I remember feeling pretty good about myself. And then it just started to overwhelm like an avalanche. And it had a strange impact. It really humbled me. It was like, all right, this is clearly none of my doing. I mean, this is the confluence of time. This is something obviously God wants to happen. And so I just kind of got out of the way of it and quit trying to take any human credit for it.
And I guess, well, how did, because I've heard Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, gets asked, what do you do when you've written the biggest book you're ever going to write? You know, how do you get back to writing something that you know won't sell as much as that? So, you know, that I think that is relatable to any author who feels like they've given everything to the last book. And like, how do you get back to the page at that point?
Yeah, it's tricky. And, you know, publishers are almost apologetic because, you know, some of my subsequent books have sold only 500,000 copies, you know, and I'm like, to me, that's a dream. And I, you know, being in the business, having been a publisher and all that, I knew how big it was. And so they say, oh, sorry about the results, you know, and I go, yeah, that's terrible that we only sold 500,000. But again, I think it's because I never wrote for material success, and my goals weren't bestsellers and award winners and big royalty checks. I mean, I love that stuff. It's been fantastic. But I used writing as a way to answer a call. And I felt like I obey just by doing it. The results aren't up to me. I can't make a book sell millions of copies. And all I can do is the best I can do. And so, you know, there comes a time. In fact, sorry to be a name dropper, but I became an acquaintance of Stephen King through all this. And one time I had written a book, which I considered my magnum opus. It was called Riven, R-I-V-E-N. It's the longest novel I ever wrote. So even if you don't like it, you can use it as a doorstop, you know. But I just felt like I'd given my all. And I thought, I've got nothing else. I can't think of another idea. And I don't feel like writing. But I remember that every time, every few years, Stephen King sort of announces his retirement. And then, what do you know, a book comes out a little bit later. And so I said to him, what is that? What is this feeling that I'm just done? And he said, believe me, I know the feeling. He said, don't do what I do and don't announce it. Because the itch comes back. You give yourself a few months. You get underfoot at home. Your wife gets tired of you being around doing nothing all the time. And then you get an idea and you just want to get back into it. And that's what happened to me. I just, I'm a writer. And so it's what I do. I don't sing or dance or preach. This is all I do.
That's great. And it's funny you say that about Stephen King, because his book, The Stand, is my favorite book. And of course, that is an apocalyptic that, could say has a lot of faith behind it and, you know, good and evil and really interesting stuff. So I'm not surprised you kind of connected over that. But I wanted to ask, there will be many people listening who are believers and who are writing in the Christian fiction market. So what do you think has changed in the Christian fiction market over the last few years? If people want to write in the genre now, do you have any tips?
Yeah, I think the biggest change has been that people who criticize that market probably haven't taken a dip into it in the last decade or so, because I have lots of colleagues, obviously, in that market, and they're writing real, gritty, hard-hitting stuff that asks difficult questions. Now, they haven't gone to the route of being too graphic, because people are still, they want the sex and language to be relegated to the general market. But even in some Christian books where it would make sense, say you're setting a book in a prison or in some, situation like that where there would be lots of language, we do have to jump through hoops to indicate what's going on but not actually use the words, because you're going to lose about a quarter of your audience automatically. They'll just be offended and say, I'm not reading that stuff. And so – but these authors are writing the gritty, hard-hitting life stuff, and not everything is all tied up in a neat bow at the end, and there's not lots of inside lingo and scriptures throughout. So I would say somebody who wants to write in that genre but thinks that it's a little bit Sunday schoolish or whatever the term used to be, check it out, because publishers are getting bolder. And they want to reach people where they are. And we're facing a lot of tough social issues these days.
No, absolutely. And that kind of ties into the nonfiction, because you have a lot of nonfiction as well, including biographies, as you mentioned, Billy Graham and Christian devotionals. So how do you balance those? Like, is one easier than the other, or do you kind of pace them one each, or, how do you decide which one to do next?
Usually I want to do something different than I've just done. In fact, when people say, I might be in the middle of writing a big novel, and somebody will say, what's your favorite thing to write? And I'll say, nonfiction, an as told to autobiography. And then I'm into one of those, and they say, what's your favorite thing? And I say, contemporary fiction, because, you get so immersed in a book. That's the thing that still amazes me, having done over 190 books. I get about three quarters of the way through every one of them and wonder, why did I ever think I could do this? It's so hard. I mean, it's just grueling. And you get to that point where you say, I can't let it flag now. I owe it to the reader to keep the tension and keep things going and make it interesting, even through that, what I call the marathon of the middle. But it's so hard that while you're doing it, it's like, I can't wait for this to be done. I don't want to shortcut the process or not give what I need to, but I just want to be done with this so I can do something else. And then the same thing happens with the next one. So I like variety. So if a really interesting people book comes up and it's a personality and a character that I like, I might take that on. But I've still got novel ideas, so I'll get back to those too.
And of course, you do a lot of research for both your fiction and your nonfiction. So how do you do your research? Like, I think you have a book called I, Saul, which is, obviously about Paul the Apostle. And, that's obviously set in the Middle East. And do you travel a lot, or do you use books or other resources?
I use everything. I like to travel where I'm setting a thing, because I've read too many novels where it's obvious the person is guessing. I read a novel where a guy had his hero in Chicago in the loop, and he was being chased. And so he raced out of the loop in his car, and he said he drove 20 miles east. Well, he'd be in Lake Michigan. So if he doesn't have an amphibious vehicle, he got that part wrong. And, having being so far from the Middle East and those countries, I just need to go there and get a feeling for the culture and the climate and all that stuff. And so I do that when I can. And when I can't, I use everything at my disposal. The internet has been fantastic. Libraries are great. Atlases, encyclopedias, tour guide type books. I had an experience where a very important scene in Left Behind needed to be set in Petra, the great city.
Wonderful place.
Carved out of stone. And that's the one place I hadn't been. And so I just immersed myself with videos from people who took people there and picture books and all that stuff. And so I did the best I could on that. And I got a lot of gratifying letters saying, oh, it's obvious you've been to Petra. And eventually I did get to go, and it was really great to see that those things had done justice to this incredible place. But usually, as I say, I like to have been there just so I don't have somebody, saying that never would happen and that's not where that's located and that type of thing.
And actually, I think you have a sign up on your website, don't you, that actually gives your tips for that type of research. I went and downloaded that.
Yeah, I do. And basically pretty much the stuff I've just said that, you know, if you don't do your research, your readers will notice. And probably my best tip on research is once you've done it, it becomes such a monumental thing in your life. I mean, for me to get to travel to the Holy Land or to go to Great Britain or whatever, it's a trip of a lifetime. And so when you start writing, you kind of want to show that off, and that's the wrong thing to do. If all of a sudden I've got two or three chapters on what it was like to ride the great Ferris wheel there in London, people go, well, apparently that's the last place he visited. So I encourage people to use research as seasoning. You know, you don't make it your main course. You just drop a few things in there so they know that it's accurate and they get the feel of the place.
Absolutely. And then I'm interested in your co-writing as well, because you've co-written with a lot of people. It's interesting. I think co-writing is something I've started to do myself. And there are obviously pros and cons and pitfalls. And you mentioned that you and Dr. LaHaye hit it off. But I wondered if you had any tips for successful co-writing or any things that have gone really badly wrong that people could learn from.
I'll tell you, it's going to sound unusual because people assume that I've done all this co-writing because I've had my name on books with other people. I don't co-write. Oh. If my name is on that book and it's fiction, I wrote every word. And if it's nonfiction, and like a first person as told to autobiography, even, I wrote every word. Now, there is some fiction that I've done with another guy, Chris Fabry. He was a protege of mine. He wanted me to teach him to improve his writing. He's a radio guy, and he really is bright and was a pretty good writer to start with. So I can't take all the credit, but he and I have done probably 50 books together. And in those, I list my name second, and he does all the writing, and I do a heavy edit and rewrite. So in that case, I'm in essence the editor, but very, you know, important part to the process. But what I hear about co-writing is that it can be a nightmare, and I don't want to lose friends. To me, the beauty, especially of fiction, you're creating your own worlds and you're, you know, building your own stories. And somebody else, you know, it might be a great thing. Once in a while, you hear about sisters who do this or best friends who do it, and it works out great. But you hear a lot of horror stories too. And so I think it's really great in the beginning to just have it out. Who's going to do the writing? Who's going to develop the story? How is this going to work? And once you've settled on that and stay with it, I think that can make it successful.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, someone doing the first draft and someone doing the edit, I think that is quite a common form of co-writing. Mm-hmm. I know quite a lot of people who do it that way because of what you're saying. And then I did another book with someone where we just took different points of view. So it is interesting how many different ways of doing it. I wondered, you know, you obviously write fast because you've put out a lot of books and you have, a lot of books per year. So what is your writing routine like and sort of, you know, your working process as such?
Yeah, I don't write all the time like a lot of people do. Stephen King, for instance, I think he writes at least something 364 days a year. I mean, he'll take, I think he said he takes Christmas Day off. And I accused him of being a slacker when he did that. And a lot of writers I know try to do that. They write, you know, several days a week. I write only when I'm on deadline. When I've got a contract and it says it's due this at this date, I keep that deadline sacred, and I'd figure out how much time I'm going to need to do that. And once it's time to write, I get away from the office. I don't, you know, because I'm too curious. So who just drove up? Who's on the phone? What's in the mail? I get away to my writing retreat, and I only write. So my day is basically, if I'm on deadline, I get up crack of dawn, and sometimes I'll work out first. But whatever, the first thing I do is I do a heavy edit and rewrite of whatever I wrote the day before. Mm-hmm. And because I'm a fast writer, that can be up to 10 pages, which is a lot. And most people don't write that much, but, I don't go back to the rough draft and keep writing until I'm happy with that, with those, you know, 8 or 10 pages that I've done the day before. So by the time I'm finished with the manuscript, I've done the rough write and I've done the rewrite. For everything, just a few pages at a time. So now I've got this, in essence, I have the second draft done. And then I go back through from page one, make sure that I've engaged the reader's senses, that I've reached for the heart, that the logic and sequence and everything makes sense. Anything that feels like it's, you know, basically I'm trying to get happy with every word. And then I don't transmit it to my publisher unless I'm totally satisfied. It still has to be edited. Everybody needs another pair of eyes. And sometimes I'll miss big things and they'll say, you know, do you realize you had this guy in World War II and you talked about Japanese soldiers, but he wasn't in the Pacific. He was in Germany, you know, so that's a pretty big mistake. But that's how I work. And it works for me. Some people need to write a whole draft before they go back and start over. My fear there is that when I'm in my second read-through, I'd find out about a third of the way in that I've made some big mistake and have to write the whole rest of it again. So that's why I do that, write one day, edit the next, and then that catapults me into writing. Mm. So I wear two different hats. When I'm doing that heavy edit and rewrite, I put on my perfectionist hat and I'm just – I'm a ferocious self-editor, but then as soon as I'm ready to write again, I just have to turn that internal editor off and take off that perfectionist cap and say, don't worry about mistakes, cliches, redundancies, anything. Just get the story down. It's a hunk of meat that's going to need to be carved, but you can carve it tomorrow.
That's great. And one of the things you said there, you said reach for the heart. And I think that's something that a lot of books are missing, and it's the thing that kind of, you know, well, it kind of almost separates fiction and nonfiction as well, but, you know, bad fiction doesn't reach for the heart. So how do you encourage your writing students to write that? You know, how do you reach for the heart?
Yeah, and it's a very fine line to walk, because you can wind up doing it in a cliched way where you set up artificial scenes just to make people cry or whatever. But I tend to quote Robert Frost, of all people, who said, mm-hmm. if there are no tears in the writer, there'll be no tears in the reader. And so the way I know whether I've reached the heart is whether it reaches me. I mean, and especially since it's fiction, I write as a process of discovery. I'm a pantser, right by the seat of my pants. I don't outline in advance. I've got an idea where I'm going. I have a basic structure. But I want the scenes to surprise me, too, and for me to be moved or disappointed or shocked or whatever by what happens with the characters. If it moves me emotionally, I know it'll move the reader emotionally. And if it doesn't, then I say, you know, I've got to look at this again and make it work without doing something phony to contrive it.
Mm, yeah, that's great. Now, I just want to just kind of switch tack, because obviously you've been writing for a long time and publishing has changed a lot in that time, obviously. And you have a blog, a very active blog. You have social media profiles. And I wondered about your thoughts on book marketing in the current environment. Now, I know you've said that some of your success has been none of your doing and the results aren't necessarily up to you, but you do put yourself out there in some way. So what do you think has changed in terms of how authors do have to do marketing?
Yeah, in many ways, it disappoints me what's happened, because I'd love to see publishers look at new writers and new manuscripts solely based on the quality of the writing and the potential, the way they did when I was getting into it. When you got an acceptance letter or encouragement from an agent or an editor, that made your week. I mean, it was like, you know, I'm making progress here and I'm going to get this done. Today, the first thing they want to know is your platform. Do you have, you know, what kind of sphere of influence do you have? What are you an expert in? How many people read your blog? And by the same token, if someone has a built-in audience, say they're a pastor of a huge church or they've got a radio show or a TV show, they don't even have to be good writers. The publishers will say, we want that audience. And so what do you want to say to that audience? We'll put a writer with you and there you go. But the fact is, it is a fact of life. And publishers, the publishing business is harder than ever for traditional publishers. So they have to be very picky more than ever. The books they do have to work. And so that they, you know, they do look for that platform and visibility. And some people say, well, I just want to write and leave that to them. There are very few of us left who can do that because of our track records. And in a sense, as you say, I'm not really leaving that to them either, because I know, as visible as my books make me, I'm forgotten in 2 weeks if I'm not on social media. And so my team has, you know, we do tweets and we do Facebook and as you say, the blog and my website. So it's just a fact of life. And and one thing I've tried not to do is to pretend I'm an expert in that book marketing and selling area. Because of my background, I haven't had to do it myself. But I love websites like yours and several others. There's some great ones in the States too, where they're just walking people through, you're going to have to sell this book. You need to contact the book dealers. You need to contact the distributors. You need to advertise yourself and get the book out there. And if you don't, it's not going to go anywhere. So I just, you know, limit myself to teaching writing and self-editing. Mm. But I do direct people to great websites that tell them how to then turn around and market their own work, even if they're traditionally published. Mm. So many are self-published, but that's even a worse problem, because if they think they can self-publish and just put a book up on Amazon or somewhere and then the money will roll in, they find out very quickly that that's not going to happen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the most the kind of disappointing moment for an author is that day after publication when it's like, exactly. Oh, nothing sold. But I think that happens with a lot of traditionally published authors as well. So you have the Jerry Jenkins Writers Guild, where you help writers become successful authors. So tell us, you know, why are you helping so many people, and what happens in the guild?
Yeah, I just felt I've been so blessed, and the industry and the business has been so good to me. I just feel obligated to pay it forward. And then once I started doing it, there's nothing I liked more, because so many people want to be writers and I see their writing and it's not good, but I realize, how could it be? They don't know. They haven't been inside. They don't know what things work and what things don't. And so I just started, you know, saying gently, I don't try to be, you know, mean to anybody. But just forthrightly say, you know, here's what needs to change to make this work. And they responded so well. So that's really why I started the Guild. We have almost 2,000 online students now, and they pay a monthly fee. Of course, my blog and that site is all free. People can get that anytime they want. But if they want a little more structure and specificity, and then that community, because they can interact with each other as well, that's what the Guild provides.
I wondered, you know, just sort of off the back of that, you know, what are the most common mistakes you see in new writers, you know, when people first feel like they want to write? What are the top mistakes they make?
Well, I think probably the two most frequent I see in fiction is they start a novel too soon in the story. Instead of getting closer to where the action is and where the real inciting incident is, they feel like they need to set up the scene. Maybe they're thinking of movies that start with a long shot and then narrow down, and you see a city, and then you see a neighborhood, and then you see a house, and then you finally that works in the movies because they can do it visually in a matter of seconds. In a novel, if you try to describe that, you're going to bore the reader to tears. Now, there's a fine line there too, because if you simply jump into a scene and it's a harrowing scene and you've, you know, got your hero in trouble and all that stuff, the reader doesn't care yet. So you need to know how to make the reader care. So the biggest mistake I see then is people that do what we call throat clearing. Instead of getting to the story, they're setting it up. They're describing the area. They're telling about the family. They're telling where this person fits in the family. And then that goes along with the second mistake, and that's introducing too many characters too soon. If a reader is introduced to more than a couple characters in the first two pages, they all of a sudden feel now, you know, which one's which, and you know, they feel like they need a program to follow the cast of characters. And I've seen people introduce 15 characters in two pages.
Wow.
And they feel like, you know, they've thought about this for so long. They know where this person fits in the family. They tell their best friends and their brothers and sisters and who does what. And I just tell them, I'm dying for a story here. So you've got 400 pages to introduce these people if they're important to the story. But for now, let's stick with your main character and find out what the issue is.
Mm. That's so funny you say that, because, you know, there are some books that seem to start with a list of characters. And whenever I've picked up a book like that, I'm like, ah, I can't read that. You know, I don't want a list of character names with who they are. It's very rare. But when I've seen it, I've been like, why would they do that?
Yeah. It does kind of set you off. It's like, if you're ready to just sit down and give your whole day for several weeks to this book, maybe that'll work. But I'd rather they tell me a story early that makes me keep turning pages.
Mm, fantastic. And final question, just sort of, you know, looking forward and into the future of publishing, because things are changing so fast right now. And of course, you've kind of got a lot of business online now, like many of us. But what are you excited about in terms of the, you know, the writing community and what's happening in publishing and what's going forward?
Well, like with most things and people, our strengths can be our weaknesses and vice versa. To me, I see it as a weakness that people can just, you know, write anything they want without any editing or input or proofreading or anything and just put it online. But on the other hand, there's no obstacle to getting stuff in print today. It used to be you write something and hope for the best, hope somebody would honor you by taking a chance on it. Now, I encourage people to exhaust their efforts to get a traditional book deal. And if they can't, or if there's a reason that their book is valid, but it's going to be a smaller audience, then it's perfectly fine to self-publish and do it right. But I'm excited about all the possibilities. It's just a wide open market. And if somebody really, really wants to be a writer, they can sure do it. There's all kinds of people teaching online, and there are all these avenues for them to publish when they get their book done.
Fantastic. Right. So where can people find you and your books and advice online?
The easiest place with me is just jerryjenkins.com. Now my guild is jerrysguild.com, but you can get to there through my main one anyway. And when you get to the guild, often it'll say registration will be open again in a few weeks or months or something. And so better to just go to jerryjenkins.com, and there's all kinds of things there. An archive of things that I've done over the past few years, plus fresh stuff every week. So look forward to seeing people.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Jerry. That was great.
Well, it's been fun to be with you, Joanna. Thanks for having me on.
So I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jerry B. Jenkins. And next week, I'm talking to an Australian iconic author, John Birmingham, who has transitioned from being firmly traditionally published through to hybrid and indie. And he shares some really honest, eye-opening stories about how publishing has changed and how mid-list authors really need to be developing their indie side in order to make a living these days. It's fascinating, honest chat. And when I lived in Australia, John seemed quite firmly anti-self-publishing. So this is a fascinating turnaround, and you'll hear just how appreciative I am in the interview next week. And of course, just a reminder, if you want to discover how you can use Scrivener to optimize your writing process and learn how I use it, as well as a value pack seminar with Joseph Michael, the Scrivener coach, join us this Thursday, 17th of August. All the details at thecreativepen.com/Scrivener17, or check out the link in the show notes. Okay, happy writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.